Hi everyone, I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Anne Ishimaru, Regina Elmi, Muna Hussein, Helen Tawanu'u, and Patricia Palomino. Dr. Ishimaru is an associate professor in the Educational Foundation's Leadership and Policy Program in the College of Education at the University of Washington. Regina Elmi is the executive director of the parent group Supporting Partnerships in Education and Beyond, and Muna, Helen, and Patricia are parent leaders within the Supporting Partnerships in Education and Beyond group. Together, they research, advocate for, and practice youth, parent, family, and community engagement throughout public schools in South King County, Washington. Thank you all for being on the podcast. So let me start by asking you, how have schools historically incorporated parents into the process of designing and shaping K-12 school policy and practice?
So I'm happy to kind of get us started on that. This is Anne. And, you know, I think one of the things that when we think about schools, we have to kind of go back historically to the role that schools played and continue to play many times in communities of color. That hasn't always been positive, that we have long histories of schools that are have been operating in ways that have actually reinforced some of the racial inequities that already exist in society. And so many of the ways that schools typically involved parents have been in very constrained, prescribed kinds of ways. So there have been these set aside spaces for parents like the PTA or parent teacher conferences or the open house. And those have really been oriented towards and privileged white middle class families who speak English, who understand the school system, who often are heterosexual families, all of the kind of white normative assumptions about who schools serve that are actually quite exclusive. And so one of the things that has been such an honor and privilege for me to learn with and from the parent leaders and the work of SPEB has been to really lean into a very different kind of paradigm and way of thinking about the role of families and communities in education as the experts and the folks without whose leadership we aren't going to be able to change our educational systems to become more just for all of our children.
So why is it so important then to center the voices and expertise of youth and families who have been marginalized in educational policy and practice and systems of change? Regina, would you like to kick us off?
You know, to answer the first question, you know, in system change, until we address who has been the most harmed, who we need to do reconciliation and restorative practice for, whose voices we need to center in co-designing and co-creating. Until we can co-create with those folks, we're never going to shift anything. And until we can imagine new and really dream new and dream liberation and see this work, that it's not work of just changing systems. It's work of our liberation. We need to let go. We need to let go of the harm that has been done, and we need to walk into it knowing that we can breathe in and breathe out, knowing that this is actually my liberation. That in order for us to create something new for generations to come, we need to live in a space of liberation. We need to let go of the past, and we need to be comfortable to imagine new and build new, not dismantle, because dismantle has never served us and it will never serve us. It is the status quo that we have been saying to people of color, that we need to dismantle systems, we need to dismantle economic development, we need to dismantle education. But it has never worked for anybody. It's never going to work for us because the system was never designed for anybody in this, any of us on this podcast today. None of us. It was never meant to welcome any of us. And some of us had to walk into the buildings with armed forces. Therefore, there's no such thing as dismantle. And when we talk about what message and what recommendations we want to give to policymakers, they need to let go of the policies that exist, and they need to allow communities to rewrite policies that centers their needs, their wants, and the hopes and dreams they have for their children.
Patricia, is there anything you'd like to say?
I think so. The school, they need thinking more in how they can connect the parents when the teacher, especially and talk for my experience, because my son changed for teachers, and you know every teacher have the time for the education, you know, the method, it's different. So when I change it for the other teacher, it's a little hard for my son learning and asking for more help, and the teacher listen to me. But many parents, they don't know how can do it. Many parents, especially because my own language is Spanish, my English is not perfect, but I try talking or looking for help or something that, because I know enrolling or I'm volunteering in different place, and I know I'm figure out why I can do it, or when what person can help me, or what person can call me, or, you know, looking for help. But many parents don't know, you know, work together and, you know, talk. Do you know what happened? Your voice is important. I hope you understand my English, sorry.
English never has to be perfect. We live in a place of multiculturalism, solidarity across cultures, and the beauty in your voice and your accent brings light to my heart. So I appreciate your language and honoring who you are. And you never need to strive to get English perfect, because it's something that we have to strip away from. So thank you.
Muna, is there anything you'd like to add?
So I'm not as nice and as Patricia. Patricia is the way she was, just very in a polite way, but I feel why community of Black and Brown community have to be engaged and have to know their what they're bringing in. This was set up and made in a white culture. It was just a white system. It's the only, they are the only people who came to this country and changed the culture they had, and say our culture and our system is better, so you're gonna come to us, the natives. But the next group who come, it's like you wipe your system and culture and come to us again. It's just so strange how that works, how you know, to just always fit that. So since we know America is a multicultural, we came from a different language, different backgrounds, I think it is so important for schools and districts to know, and also not only to know our cultures, but also our cultures and our languages and our backgrounds has to shape the new way of education. Unless that happens, then it's not going to be a fair, it's not going to be equal. So we are still outsiders.
Helen, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think the system itself, it's already is designed, and I do agree with Muna. I think the system itself is not, it's not going by the rules. I think the rules are only put out there when it's our kids, like our dark-skinned kids. If we're not white, then, you know, the rules actually apply. And if you are white, then you can do whatever. I don't know. That's from my experience. With the public school itself, it's hard to actually be the parent there, because we tell them what's going on with our kid, but they're not listening. And then we got some of the teachers are crying because they can't help. The system itself is saying no, but the teacher knows better how to help our kid. And they're getting a no from that side. So it's like the teachers are caught in the middle, and they don't know what to say.
So I think that's a perfect segue into our second question. There have been so many challenges this past year, and hopefully lessons that have been learned as we've all experienced those challenges together. So what do you want districts to learn from this past year?
I am a parent and also advocate and also works as a better educator for elementary school. So I spend many hours with young, beautiful kids of, you know, four, third, second graders. And one of the things I feel is we get really an opportunity, but we are losing it, is knowing those kids, where they come from, what homes they were coming from, what cultures they were bringing, what was the background of that, because every teacher is in that house every day now. So not only you seeing the, you know, the language, the connection, the relationship, what is going on, the also the struggle, the style, the what is known for that family. So instead of criminalizing and saying they were not fit parents because, you know, the house was loud or that there was a this and that, and what is the opportunity those teachers is going to bring to understand those students when they come back to the school? Well, is there anybody who is really documenting that boy who, you know, that family who was struggling coming from that house, that family of seven? And I support one student who is a fourth grader and nine, there are eight children, two bedrooms. And the best mother who creates in a way to all her kids to can stay in the Zoom, but it's just two bedrooms. You know what I mean? What is the understanding of that? How can districts support those students and understand the behavior they might be coming with, the cultures they're coming with, the struggle they're coming with? Or should it is going to be just back to whatever, you know, we used to call normal? So that is really either opportunity, we could, you know, use it and benefit, or we would just lose it again till something other than this hits us again.
I do appreciate having gone to Rainier Prep because I felt more family oriented, to the point that we were heard through Muna and through Regina, even though it was hard to put our culture and everything that we are within this school. We were wanting to start this uncle and auntie within the school, each school, to always have them there. They already exist, but we don't have a voice within the school itself, the district, or whatever have you. But we're very powerful to the point that we actually can help the kids and the families, and we can eliminate all the other stuff that that the school districts always offer. Because at the end of the day, I'm gonna call Regina if I need help. I'm gonna call Muna. I'm not gonna call whoever they told me to call, because it takes so long to get that help. By the time we get the help, it's already been 3 years, which I can just go to Regina and Muna, which already are in the system. They can help me and get me like that. So I'm addressing to see if we can actually have them in these schools and have a voice where they can stand up for the schools. I mean, for the students that are struggling emotionally, physically, getting bullied. I mean, you name it. These uncle and aunties will step up and make sure that they're heard, and for these families. Bring that village to each school. They always say that, but it's not happening.
I think one of the things about that idea that's so powerful is that it really draws on the sort of collective caregiving that exists in so many of our non-dominant cultures already. And I think all these district leaders and policymakers right now are kind of scrambling, and they're talking about, you know, there's this whole narrative on learning loss and the sort of trauma that children have experienced and all the disruption. And I think it kind of really came out of hearing some of our young people voicing what their experiences have been and some of the damage they've experienced, partly at the hands of educators and schools. And then we have all these movements to try to get more culturally responsive, educators and different packages, social emotional learning packages. And part of what is powerful, I think, about what Helen and Regina and all these folks are putting on the table is that some of that expertise is already here. We don't have to look at it in some package. We don't have to, we still want to do the professional development to get greater cultural responsiveness, but we actually have folks who are experts on their own cultures, on their own communities, on their own children, on their own language, on the learning needs and priorities of their children.
Yeah, I want to say too, the culture is very important. The school know every culture, my culture, Muna culture, because they make a connection. I understand Muna culture, Regina culture. They understand my culture. I understand your culture, Anne, or maybe Chris. And this better because it's more, I don't know what is the word, but it's
solidarity.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And the kids too, growing, understand the culture, you know, they learning new culture, they learning why you use this, you clothes, they learning why you eat different that they're there, and understand, they need understand. We say, Muna, why I know I'm living this in this country, and why I need to learn the culture, and they don't learn about the us culture. They need it too because they know about anything about us, they don't understand. They need to learn a little bit, maybe not too much, but only a little bit.
You know, when we talk about equity, we really have to define what equity means, right? Who needs it the most? And when we say who needs it the most, it's not a guilt and it's not something that you're giving. It's not something that you're saying like, oh, I'm just giving this thing because you need it the most. It's honoring historical context. It's honoring restorative practice. It's honoring like my way walking into liberation, right? And like my accountability and my share of responsibility. You know, when we talk about giving a recommendation or advice to policymakers around system change, to really think about, I think a culture of fate, a culture of adaptive, right? We need to move away from the neurons that have been used because they haven't worked for us. And when we talk about, you know, culture of adaptive, really, how is it that our systems, you know, school systems and policymakers are going to be comfortable? And how much are they really going to be okay with adapting to a new way? Adapting to the recommendations of our students and our families, our community members, those that have not been served by the system historically. How is it that we're going to adapt to Indigenous ways? How is it that we're going to adapt centering anti-Blackness and doing restorative practice? How are we going to adapt to, you know, recognizing that you cannot go around talk about undocumentation and immigration because everybody walked in here as an immigrant in this nation and none of us were welcomed here. And like, if we learn one thing during the pandemic, it's really that our families and our students and our neighborhoods and our villages hold the power, because it was everyday mom like Patricia, Helen, and I and Muna who literally became the teachers for our own babies, not only for our babies, but other babies. And like, we were getting on phone calls and asking like, what's working for you? How are you navigating the Zoom call? Like, what are you doing about this? How's the schedule going? And I think those are the heroes of the pandemic.
I think, you know, earlier on, I guess it must have been last summer, we got together and had a series of conversations, and some of the things that Patricia is referring to also sort of translated into what families were experiencing while their kids were doing remote schooling, in terms of the negative, these sort of micro interactions with teachers and the ways that they were playing out. And then now all of a sudden parents could see and hear it when they're on the other side of the screen. And especially a lot of Black families talked about that their kids were actually happier at home. They were safer. They weren't facing this sort of daily micro and macro aggressions. And then also just that, you know, again, to the point around culture, like that there were all kinds of things that families were doing to support their children in learning during the time. And it wasn't always things that like would show up on a standardized state assessment, but really important, powerful and connected deep learning about their cultures. They were speaking their home languages at home. Some of them were taking advantage of the electronic connections and were doing classes in Somalia, for example, and studying the Quran. So there were all kinds of, you know, there are people who are, you know, participating in the protests during the summer. And really learning about the histories of protest and resistance and resilience in their communities. They were taking care of their families and communities, going out and helping with the food distribution, all those kinds of things. So, you know, when we think about what we mean by having well-educated kids, the definitions, I think, and the ideas that families of color bring to that conversation are much more expansive, and much more about being good human beings in a society that embraces difference. And you know, I think that it also highlighted, though, the ways in which the pandemic was really making some of those inequities worse too. And you know, to Regina's point, the conversation about going back to school has been very contentious and very racialized, and we still have more Black and Brown children who are in remote schooling than we do in buildings, and there's a disproportionate impact we know of the health impacts and all of the things that are happening in the world right now.
So what recommendations do you have for policymakers?
I think so. One recommendation is looking in one police. I don't know how making the police, but maybe they thinking in own police working for the school or for, you know, that. But they don't thinking that police is working for everybody or for the community or for the different culture. So maybe they need thinking in the police is right, working for everybody, or is working only for my own benefits, you know, for everybody.
I would say, I mean, going back to what I already earlier said, is that really making sure that you're doing policy and advocacy through a social justice healing approach, and that you're making sure that you're centering the voices of those that historically have not been part of policy, have not been written into policy, have not been designing policy, and that as a policymaker, your job is actually to step back and let them write their own history.
I was really, I'm following what Patricia said, and it's something touched me. Whew. What is the cultures? What is the things those students bring to those schools? Also, those policies are also including also that. And one thing also I would say is to them, because I sometimes sit at spaces where as a parents we have to talk to, whether it's the senator's office or, you know, Congress or something, there is always not somebody look like the people who's talking to them. did not have that background, did not go through that experience, and they could be the nicest to human beings, but if they really did not, don't have that history, don't have that background, it is just a story to them. So maybe also in their offices, those policymakers, instead of every window they get bringing a young white person coming and growing from there and becoming the leader of that office, and then another young one is coming, maybe they have to be open also for multicultural and background people.
Well, my first question will be, can it be changed? And how long would it change? My kids only got 3 more years and then they're done with school. Is it going to happen within those 3 years? Like, we've been trying forever to change and it always gets shot down all the time. Like these bills that actually support what we know that actually works for everyone. It's all over the world. It's going to fit because we actually call these all the kids. Those are nephew and nieces. And vice versa, we're their aunties and uncles. It's the same thing. That's the thing. They always say, oh, it takes a village to raise one kid. Where's the village at? The village don't even exist. You know, we there, but you're not giving us the time so we can talk. Where's the mic so I can drop it after I speak? Like, come on now. Let's do this.
Oh,
like,
my God.
It's working.
Part of what Helen's saying just is so key, as just sort of like this idea that we're just gonna do business as usual, we're gonna put a couple of token people on a committee, or we're gonna do another listening session. Like, folks are done with that. And those are really ways in which the system moves to look like it's being responsive. But in many ways, actually just exacerbates the dynamics in which especially families of color feel like they're not being listened to, that they don't have the influence. And there's a real tension in there about what does it mean for policymakers and people in formal leadership roles to take seriously not only the negative experiences and traumas of families, but also the power and the resilience and the cultural practices and the dreams and possibilities that they're putting on the table. And that sometimes means for policymakers that we have to really reconfigure how we understand going about these processes, the testimony, the committees, all of those kinds of things. We have to rethink how we make policy, how we implement policy, what is the role of families and communities in those processes. And I think ultimately some of that has to entail some unlearning on the part of formal leaders. And then one of the things that's really beautiful, I think, about the relationships and solidarities that you can hear, I think, in the interactions, is that collectively, folks are learning about each other. They're learning about the systems and the histories. And then also there are educators in these spaces as well. And so they're collectively learning together and building their capacity to make systems change, to create a new and different way of doing education. And they're doing that by recognizing each other's expertise, realizing that nobody has the sole expertise, learning from each other and learning collectively together towards the kinds of futures we want to realize.
Thank you, Anne, Regina, Mona, Helen, and Patricia. Again, together they research, advocate for, and practice youth, parent, family, and community engagement throughout public schools in South King County, Washington. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Gloria Ledson Billings, the president of the National Academy of Education and the former Kellner Family Distinguished Professor of Urban Education in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. As always, thanks for listening. We hope that you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis of education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.